KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I'd say the word surprising. Gasoline prices fell, which I think is a welcome news for a lot of consumers, especially as we get into the summer.
May numbers are in, and inflation barely rose last month. What's that tell us about the overall economy?
For Wednesday, June 11th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead this hour, new poetry written to try to capture a particular moment in time.
Danica Kelly wanted to write about feeling powerless.
I never learned how to get free. I never learned how not to have anyone's blood on my own soft hands.
And staying with the arts, the new movie I Don't Understand You follows a couple's vacation in Italy.
Yeah, a vacation that goes wrong in every possible way.
It's not your typical rom-com. It's not a typical horror film. It didn't really fit into the normal gay genre of film.
Those stories after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. Dozens of Southern California mayors joined Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass today to demand the Trump administration stop stepped-up immigration raids and pull back from having military troops alongside immigration enforcement agents. Bass saying Trump's deployment of thousands of National Guard troops and 700 Marines only raises the temperature.
When you raid Home Depots and workplaces, when you tear parents and children apart, and when you run armored caravans through our streets, you're not trying to keep anyone safe. You're trying to cause fear and panic.
An 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew in downtown Los Angeles will be in effect for a second night tonight. While there were arrests of demonstrators last night, most were for curfew violations. At an event at the Kennedy Center in Washington tonight, Trump continued to say without his deployment of the National Guard, L.A. would, quote, be burning to the ground. The Trump administration plans to repeal limits on greenhouse gas pollution from the country's fossil fuel power plants. NPR's Jeff Brady reports the move is part of President Trump's efforts to boost domestic coal, oil, and gas industries.
Electricity-generating power plants are the second largest source of greenhouse gases in the U.S., behind transportation. Still, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin says it's possible to protect both the environment and the economy.
Rest assured, President Trump is the biggest supporter of clean, beautiful coal.
To justify the proposal, EPA concludes that greenhouse gases from fossil fuel-fired power plants do not contribute significantly to dangerous air pollution. Meredith Hankins is an attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
If U.S. power plants were a country, their carbon emissions would be sixth globally. If that's not significant, I'm not sure what is.
Hankins says the finalized rules likely will be challenged in court. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has named 8 new members to the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee days after firing the previous panel. As NPR's Ping Wong explains, the new panel is expected to bring a different perspective.
The new committee includes several people who rose to prominence during the COVID pandemic as critics of government policies. They include Martin Kulldorff, who advocated against lockdowns, and Dr. Robert Malone, who spread false claims about the dangers of COVID vaccines. Another member, Vicky Pebsworth, has served on the board of the National Vaccine Information Center, a prominent advocacy group that warns against vaccine risks. Dr. Cody Meissner is the only repeat member of the committee. According to a database created by Kennedy's team, he declared conflicts of interest 12 times in his previous tenure from 2008 to 2012. The CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee makes recommendations on how vaccines should be used to help prevent disease and promote public health. Ping Huang, NPR News.
Stocks closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow was down a point. The Nasdaq fell 99 points. You're listening to NPR. Entertainment giant Walt Disney's agreed to pay Comcast NBC Universal nearly $439 million for its stake in Hulu. The deal means Disney will now have full control of the streaming service. Disney took a 33% stake in Hulu in 2023. Beach Boys founder, songwriter, and producer Brian Wilson has died. He was 82 years old. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports Wilson took the 3-minute pop song into new dimensions, leaving an indelible mark on American music.
Brian Wilson was a California boy who became famous singing about California girls. The 1966 album Pet Sounds, produced when Wilson was suffering from hallucinations and depression, that sealed his reputation as a musical mastermind, as fellow rock star Linda Ronstadt told NPR in 2020.
It was a revelation. Brian Wilson is a genius. I love his music. It cheered me up.
In his later years, Wilson's musical projects included a reunion album and tour with the Beach Boys. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
It's your chance to own some of the most iconic props in Hollywood history, including the Rosebud sled from Citizen Kane, Macaulay Culkin's snow hat from Home Alone, and the whip used by Harrison Ford in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. July 15th, sale is being held by Heritage Auctions, also on the block. Be the filming miniature of Luke Skywalker's X-Wing starfighter and lightsabers used by Obi-Wan Kenobi. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Good news today for American shoppers. Retail prices rose less than expected last month. This despite the tariffs that President Trump has imposed on nearly everything that the U.S. imports. Trump celebrated the encouraging inflation report with a post on social media, and he once again called on the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates. NPR's Scott Horsley joins me once again. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So this seems like positive news. How would you describe the big news in today's inflation report?
Well, the big news is there really wasn't a lot of big news. You know, inflation was pretty subdued last month. Prices rose just 0.1% between April and May. Stephen Cates, who's a financial analyst at Bankrate, says that's about half the price increase we saw the previous month and about half what forecasters had expected.
I'd say in a word, surprising. This is certainly tame. Gasoline prices fell, which I think is a welcome news for a lot of consumers, especially as we get into the summer. And that did offset some of the increases we saw elsewhere.
Some costs are still going up, like rent, but not as fast as it was. There was a sizable jump in grocery prices, but egg prices continue to come down, which is a welcome relief for lots of folks. Airline tickets and new and used cars also got cheaper last month. What we don't see in this inflation report is a lot of extra expenses tied to the president's worldwide tariffs, even though May was the first full month those import taxes were in effect.
So what does that mean? Does that mean we, by which I mean we consumers who buy things like eggs and plane tickets, we don't have to worry about the tariffs?
Not necessarily. It's possible the bulk of those tariffs just haven't worked their way down to the retail cash register just yet. We did see some price increases on things like toys and appliances, which could reflect the cost of Trump's tariffs. But overall, goods prices were flat in May, and the price of a lot of imported items like clothing and furniture actually came down. That might mean retailers are just selling the stuff out of the warehouse that they stockpiled before the tariffs took effect. Kate says it could be a few months before we know for sure.
I wouldn't say we're out of the woods. The fact that clothing, footwear, automobiles have not started to incorporate any tariff-induced prices is good, but those things still could happen.
Importers are now paying a tax of at least 10% on goods from around the world, and those rates could go higher next month. Goods from China are being taxed at least 30%. Now, some of that extra cost could be absorbed by companies along the way, but experience suggests at least some of it will be passed on to consumers.
So to the big question, President Trump calling yet again for the Fed to cut interest rates. If inflation is indeed fairly tame right now, is there room for the Fed to heed that demand?
Yeah, Trump certainly thinks so. He sent out an all-caps message saying the Fed should cut rates by a full percentage point, arguing that would lower the government's own interest costs on the very large federal debt. By the way, the Treasury Department said today those interest payments totaled $776 billion so far this year, and we're only two-thirds of the way through the fiscal year. However, Fed policymakers are not expected to cut rates when they meet next week. The central bank is still concerned that the tariffs could rekindle higher inflation in the months to come. So for now, at least, the Fed's going to proceed with caution.
Last quick thing, Scott. There were big tariff talks this week in London between the U.S. and China. Did that change the picture at all?
It didn't change the tariff picture, although I guess it's relief that the tariffs aren't going to go even higher. We don't know a lot of details about what was agreed to, but it seems that the two sides have kind of gone back to where they were after the earlier trade talks in Geneva. Both countries reportedly agreed to relax some export restrictions, and for the U.S. that means more access to rare earth minerals. But those 30% tariffs on goods from China remain in effect.
And Pierre Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
Protests across the country have continued over President Trump's deportation policies. While the administration initially said that its focus was on hardened criminals, ICE has now increasingly been going into workplaces, hoping to meet Trump's goal of 3,000 deportations a day. But how are Americans thinking about what Trump is doing? Well, to talk about that, we're going to bring in NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, great to be with you.
Great to be with you. Okay, so what indications do we have so far on how people are feeling towards Trump's immigration and deportation policies right now?
In general, Trump gets better marks on immigration than on other things. There was a CBS poll out this week that found 54% approve of Trump's deportation policies. We should say that that was conducted last week and didn't ask specifically about the situation in Los Angeles. And there was a Quinnipiac poll out today showing the opposite, with 56% disapproving of his deportation policies. But multiple polls since November have consistently shown that people trust the Republican Party more to handle immigration. It's pretty notable that Trump gets better marks on immigration than the economy, for example. That's a reversal from his first term. But it's not like 54% is very high, Elsa.
Yeah.
I mean, it still reflects a pretty sharp split in the country considering the passionate opposition. And there's always the risk of Trump going too far.
What do you mean going too far? Say more about that risk.
Well, we are seeing some Republican lawmakers raise concerns. Congressman David Valadao, a Republican from a swing district in California, said he's concerned about the administration's deportation policy shift to workplaces. He said he's urging them to prioritize the removal of known criminals over the hardworking people who've lived peacefully in the country for years, and that was a quote. Tony Gonzalez is a Republican congressman from Texas. He's chairman of the Congressional Hispanic Republican Conference. He summed it up this way on CNN yesterday.
We all need to focus on convicted criminal illegal aliens. If we focus there and we're, you know, we're not going after the milker of cows who's, you know, at, in 103 degree weather, going after that guy, and we're going after the convicted criminal, I think we're on the right path.
Of course, there are a lot of people in the White House who disagree with that, particularly someone like Stephen Miller, who's been an architect of a lot of President Trump's hardline policies focused on culture, whether it's immigration or transgender rights or diversity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's all from the Republican side. But what about Democrats? Like, what are you hearing from them?
It's tricky. Lots of Democrats have been biting their nails on this issue because they lost in 2024, and immigration is something that Trump focused heavily on. But there are lots of progressive activists who feel that Democratic leaders are not standing up for immigrants as strongly as they should be. I talked to Joel Payne, a Democratic strategist. He thinks that that line can be walked, but it needs to be communicated effectively.
The lesson or the signal from voters is not abandon immigrants. But what voters do want is a clear and cogent policy around how you manage the country's borders. This is a redux of Barack Obama's famous, we're a nation of immigrants and we're a nation of laws.
And that can be a pretty delicate line to walk, especially when you have a current progressive base that wants to see more fight from Democrats and aren't exactly fired up right now about the pragmatism that marked Obama's politics.
Well, President Trump, I have to ask, I mean, he seems pretty eager for this fight. And what is it about this political moment you think that makes him feel confident that he has an advantage on this issue?
Well, this is all about those increased border crossings that we saw during the Biden administration. In 2017, when Trump first took office, Gallup found that 35% said that they wanted immigration decreased. Gallup's latest data from last year showed that that's gone up 20 points. Hmm. That was the highest in the survey since October of 2001. Now, that was a month after 9/11, but it was also the last time encounters at the southern border were as high as they had been in the last couple of years. So Trump's core beliefs on immigration suddenly aligned with more Americans. But again, there's risk of him going too far. And when it comes to the politics of all of this, we shouldn't overlook that his response to what's happening in LA does change the subject from the big topic last week, his split from Elon Musk, to ground he's more comfortable with here, immigration.
That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Thank you, Domenico.
You're welcome.
Every so often, you run across a poem that seems to capture perfectly a moment in time. Well, one of our correspondents, Netta Ulaby, felt that way when she recently encountered this one by poet Danica Kelly.
Danica Kelly was living quietly in western New York State. She had her first job teaching writing. It was 2018. At the time, U.S. drone strikes and military conflicts were killing scores of civilians in Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen, and Pakistan.
There was a lot of coverage in the news about the drones dropping bombs and there being civilian casualties.
In response, she wrote a poem. It's called I Never Figured Out How to Get Free.
I'm going to read it. Is that okay? The war was all over my hands. I held the war and I watched them die in high definition. I could watch anyone die, but I looked away. Still, I wore the war on my back. I put it on every morning. I walked the dogs, and they too wore the war. The sky overhead was clear, or it was cloudy, or it rained, or it snowed, and I was rarely afraid of what would fall from it. I worried about what to do with my car, or how much I could send my great aunt this month and the next. I ate my hamburger, I ate my pizza, I ate a salad or lentil soup, and this too was the war. At times, I was able to forget that I was on the wrong side of the war, my money and my typing and sleeping sound at night. I never learned how to get free. I never learned how not to have anyone's blood on my own soft hands.
It felt scary to share this poem because it does feel so impotent.
This poem is about failing to feel anything but powerless, she says. And it's a record or an artifact about paying attention and caring in spite of feeling so powerless at this time and in this place. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
And Danica Kelly's upcoming collection of poetry is called The Natural Order of Things.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station. This is NPR.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The movie I Don't Understand You starts with a couple in Los Angeles making an audition tape.
We see the adoption process as an amazing opportunity to look at our whole lives and think about how much joy our child would bring.
Nope, we can't say our child.
What?
No, you have to say the baby or your baby. Okay. We can't just assume that it's our child already. So.
Okay.
Dom and Cole want to adopt a baby. As they film their appeal to the birth mom, they try earnestness.
And we know that choosing parents for your child is a very complicated decision, so we just want to thank you for considering us.
Yeah.
And silliness.
Please give us your baby.
Please.
And with that as the opening scene, the movie gallops off in a surprising direction. Dom and Cole fly to Italy before a baby arrives, and their dream vacation becomes a disaster, as the movie becomes a horror comedy with a staggering body count.
Okay, but this has to be the last one.
Absolutely. I don't want to do this anymore.
No, this can't be like a thing we start doing in LA.
Nick Kroll and Andrew Rannells star as the married couple Dom and Cole. And they told me that audition video was based on something the two of them created as a sort of sizzle reel for the movie.
It was sort of a way to sell the idea of Andrew and I as a couple, the vibe, the sort of tone of what we were trying to go for. And we shot that together. And it was obviously very fun and became so kind of fun and useful that then we put it into the film itself. Not that actual sizzle reel, yeah. but a version of what we had shot.
You two have collaborated on a lot of projects together, the animated TV show Big Mouth, the Broadway show All In. I think this is the first time you've played husbands. Do you find your off-screen dynamic is sort of that of a married couple, even if one of you is actually married to a woman in real life?
It was. I mean, it is in a lot of ways. And the thing that was a real gift of our partnership as we were making this was that Nick and I are both pretty even keeled, but you know, we were working under some sort of, at times, some rather extreme circumstances in terms of a lot of stunts and at night. And I really feel like we took turns getting impatient. And any time that I started to get a little tense, Nick would bring me a snack. Aww. Nick would make me laugh. And I hope that.
And Andrew, what would you do when Nick got impatient?
Well, I would, he liked candy. So I would, you know, get him some candy or maybe like a little espresso. We didn't murder anyone, which I think is the big key point. Nick and I did not actually.
That's a win.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I think that our friendship really grew in the course of making this because it really did reflect in some ways what this couple was going through.
I agree. I would just add that like we did switch back and forth. The dynamic between Cole and Dom, the characters that we play, is one seems slightly more grounded and one is a little more prone to diving into
hysterics.
Right.
And I would say that Andrew and I sort of alternated in those roles with each other, depending on who needed it most that day. And I really do think it translated into the film.
See, I was wondering if filming it in Italy was kind of like an Italian honeymoon experience off camera, but it sounds like off camera, maybe it was closer to the nightmare that the movie itself depicts.
Well, in a lot of ways, we did start in Rome and we did a lot of like really beautiful, like walking down the street and in front of the Spanish Steps and Trevi Fountain and all of that was all really fun and beautiful. And then it very slowly crept into the reality of what we were filming. So we did get a little of both and we had some good dinners. We ate a lot of carbonara.
Yeah.
Yeah. The writer and director couple are themselves married, David Joseph Craig
yes.
and Brian Crano. Were there any moments on set that you felt like the two of them were reflecting the spousal dynamic that you were playing on screen back at you?
The truth is that it's largely based on their experiences. One, they were trying to adopt a child and were scammed. They were truly scammed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like our characters in the film. And when you meet us at the beginning of the film, our characters are, you know, a few months out of getting scammed. They think they're going to get a baby that they've been trying to adopt. And it turns out that some person had falsified these papers. There was no baby.
Oh.
And that really happened to David and Brian. And they also had a nightmare vacation in Italy where they got like stuck in a ditch and sprayed with mud and everything went wrong.
I had no idea this was so grounded in reality.
Yes,
it seems so far-fetched.
I know.
Except Ari for the murder. Once again,
right.
David and Brian, as far as we know, did not murder anyone on that trip.
They merged these two things that really happened to them into a movie. And really, in the film, Andrew and I find out that we are going to be able to finally adopt a child, Amanda Seyfried's child, not actually Amanda Seyfried, the actress, but she plays
Bummer.
A character. I know. We would have killed everybody.
It's a cute kid. Baby.
So we find out during the trip that we're going to be able to adopt her baby. And so we are now on a mad dash to get back. And really the movie is a metaphor for what you will do to get your child. If you're a couple, in the case of David and Brian, like, you'll do anything to finally have that opportunity. And David and Brian found a very clever way to express that in raising the stakes just a little bit.
There was one question that kept popping into my head as the plot kind of becomes more and more absurd and things go more and more off the rails. And I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but the question I kept having was, how did this get made?
It's a great question. It's a great question. And, you know, honestly, I'm not sure if we have a succinct answer to that. It's not your typical rom-com.
It's not your typical anything,
horror
really.
Film. No, it's not. It's you know, one of the reasons that I was really excited about it is that it didn't really fit into the normal, like, gay genre of film or queer cinema. Like, it also didn't really, I couldn't find anything that also looked like that in that canon. So that was exciting. And I have to imagine that all of those pieces together, that it was, everything's just a little off center on this film. And I think that's what perhaps attracted the kind folks that gave us the money to make this film.
The movie's out now. Big Mouth is about to end its 8-season run. Do the two of you now have to go back to just being ordinary friends, or do you have some other plot up your sleeves to work together?
I would solely work with Nick for the rest of my career, if that was an option.
I mean, if it was like a Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney situation.
Mickey Rooney.
Yeah.
Do I even need to ask who's who?
Am I Judy? I might be Judy, depending on the day.
There's a little Judy in all of us,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And my weight fluctuation, I guess, maybe more of a Mickey. Well, yeah.
I mean, God willing, we'll get back to the studio system where we're under contract at MGM for 40 years and we can just keep making movies together. And maybe there will be room for I Don't Understand You Too.
I still don't understand you.
I still don't understand you.
Yeah. You're welcome. Yeah. You can have that for free.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You heard it here.
Andrew Rannells and Nick Kroll star in the movie I Don't Understand You, which is out now. You guys, it's been so great talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ari.
This is NPR News.
After one hurricane after another in recent years, some Florida businesses learned to deal with flooding in a new way by putting appliances on higher ground and just letting the water in.
We're going to open the front door, open the back door, let the water flow through, because we've learned if we have movement of the water, the mud doesn't stick around.
This week, we're reporting on ways people are finding climate solutions. Hear more on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
That's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. Hurricane Helene washed away thousands of private roads and bridges in North Carolina.
Who is going to rebuild them all?
We're getting people, their bridges and their driveways and their culverts put back together. And we're also putting money back into our community.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. On April 1st, the Department of Health and Human Services told thousands of staffers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that they were losing their jobs. Today, more than 400 were told that's no longer the case. NPR's Kiara Eisner has this update.
More than 400 CDC staff who thought they had lost their jobs have just been told that that decision is being rescinded. That was confirmed in an email sent to staff by the CDC's director for the National Center for HIV, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention that NPR reviewed. 214 of the people now being asked to return to work are from that center. The news was met by staff with, quote, both excitement and uncertainty, wrote the director, Dr. Renata Ellington. She added that she didn't know why some were brought back and others were not. Kiara Eisner, NPR News.
Protests over the Trump administration's immigration enforcement practices are happening not just here in Los Angeles, but in other parts of the country as well. Demonstrations also growing in Chicago, Columbus, Ohio, New York City, Connecticut, even San Antonio, Texas. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt says the immigration raids will continue.
The Trump administration is going to continue the mass deportation effort that the president promised the American public. Many of you were at those rallies in cities and communities across the country when the president spoke about his commitment to removing violent illegal criminals and anyone who has broken our nation's immigration laws from American communities.
A nightly curfew imposed here in L.A. helped to quell further clashes between police and protesters overnight. The National Guard and active duty Marines are still here in Los Angeles, but Mayor Karen Bass says local law enforcement is more than capable of handling any confrontations, and a second curfew goes into effect later tonight. This is NPR. The city of Seattle is working to balance its need for more housing with the need to preserve and grow more trees to combat the effects of climate change, from member station KNKX. Bellamy Palethorpe reports.
Seattle is under pressure to add more homes, but the latest assessment of its urban canopy, which provides shade and pulls carbon emissions from the air, shows the city has been losing trees. A recent update of Seattle's tree protection ordinance allows developers to more easily remove trees, but also requires them to plant more replacements. Cameron Willett does small lot infill development in Seattle for the Canadian home builder Intracorp.
Trees make better communities. We all want to save the trees, right? But we also need to be able to get to our max density as well.
Critics of the policy say the city is still losing too many trees and that it will take decades to replace the shade and ecosystem services provided by mature trees. For NPR News, I'm Bellamy Palethorpe in Seattle.
The government's latest cost of living report shows inflation was slightly lower than forecasters had expected last month, even as President Trump's global tariffs war began to take hold. Consumer prices up 2.4% in May compared with a year ago. While the cost at the gas pump fell, groceries, toys, and large appliances rose. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. At the moment, the front line of the battle over immigration is Los Angeles. President Trump has warned his administration will not allow an American city to be, quote, invaded. The state of California has sued the Trump administration for what it sees as a breach of state sovereignty. Well, for insight into the conservative strategy around immigration, we have called Simon Hankinson, senior research fellow in the Border Security and Immigration Center at the Heritage Foundation. Welcome.
Thank you.
Your top line assessment of the situation as it stands in LA, and I'll ask that more colloquially, if I bumped into you tonight at a dinner party and asked, hey, I've been away, what's going on in LA? How would you answer?
Well, business as usual. I think it was predictable that increased enforcement or any enforcement of immigration law in the interior after 4 years of basically ignoring the law would have an impact on major cities. And sooner or later, there were going to be demonstrations. There was going to be, something like the May 2020 riots, demonstrations, whatever you want to call them, public displays of unhappiness. And Los Angeles.
You're talking about people in the streets after the George Floyd situation.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
But I guess my question, just to jump in, if I were again asking you what's happening in LA right now, is it going, in your view, is it going well? Is it going poorly? Anything surprising you?
Unfortunately, I'm not surprised. I think the enforcement is going well on the whole, but in California, obviously, it's hit a bit of a political obstacle. What we're seeing is the city of Los Angeles and the state of California resisting federal efforts to enforce immigration law. And we're not talking about presidential directives here, executive orders. We're talking about immigration law passed by Congress, a bipartisan law signed by presidents, Democrat as well as Republican.
So you've started to answer this, but I'll just put it to you directly. To those who argue, look, this is the Trump administration who is now claiming credit for averting a crisis, for tamping down violence, but this was perhaps a crisis of the administration's own making. There weren't any protests in LA until ICE agents went in. What do you say?
Well, I guess if you take that line of reasoning, then what you're saying is the federal government cannot enforce immigration law. And if they do, the price is there'll be violence in the street. You know, that's sort of an extortion, really, by a state, a nullification of federal law. And I do understand the president is he's making a stand here because he can probably see that this will happen in other cities and other states.
The president has taken some unusual steps in L.A., and I want to ask you specifically about sending active duty military over the objections of state and local leaders. In your view, is that justified?
I think it's justified when you have a threat to federal property and when you have local authorities that are unwilling to keep the peace and to protect lives. We saw in Portland in 2020, a federal building was taken over. We saw federal property damaged. We saw a lot of people injured and a couple billion dollars worth of property damage. There's already been some looting and some property damage in Los Angeles. And I think that's something that the administration really wants to avoid this time.
And I'll note that we're seeing reports of fewer clashes Tuesday night. A curfew has kicked in. 200 plus people were arrested. That's LAPD statistics. Local law enforcement says, we've got this. We can handle it.
Well, maybe they say that now, but what would they have said had there been no federal response whatsoever? We saw in 2020, and we've seen at other periods, local officials essentially letting these things burn out. You know, let's just let them burn some cars and trash some buildings, and then we'll go in afterwards. And this time it died down much quicker. And I think the threat, the real threat that there would be an active federal presence was what caused local authorities to crack down earlier than they would, for example, with the curfew that Mayor Bass put on.
I mean, I guess if the goal is law and order, if the goal is avoiding ending chaos, I suppose we should note that protests have spread to cities across the country. We're seeing reports from Seattle, from Dallas, from Chicago, from Boston. So what counts as victory here?
I think tactically, victory is that the riots or the demonstrations, rather, don't get out of control, that people are allowed to demonstrate peacefully. They're allowed to express their opinions, but that we don't have wide-scale looting, property damage, and the ruining of lives in generally poor and underprivileged or business parts of our major cities. That would be a tactical victory. The strategic victory would be that we once again go back to enforcing our immigration law and not ignoring it.
Simon Hankinson of the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
It has been 9 months after Hurricane Helene, and many North Carolinians still cannot move back home. The storm washed away small bridges over streams and creeks, cutting off access to houses in the mountains of Appalachia. In our ongoing series, Here to Help, Zachary Turner with member station WFAE reports on how one nonprofit has a unique way of rebuilding those bridges.
The weeks after the storm, helicopter pilot Leith Davis ran supplies to stranded residents in Lansing, North Carolina, using his off-road vehicle. Here's Davis in October of last year.
We've got a bunch of private bridges up here that, aren't under DOT's purview, so it's going to be a while before, those folks are able to, drive to their house.
Hurricane Helene damaged more than 7,000 private bridges, roads, and culverts in western North Carolina. Many folks still can't reach their homes by car. In the mountains of western North Carolina, there is limited space to build houses. That means they pop up in valleys alongside streams and creeks, often with only one road in. So Leith and his wife Emily Davis, a structural engineer, went from running supplies over damaged roads and bridges to repairing them.
Now we're getting people, their bridges and their driveways and their culverts put back together. And we're also putting money back into our community.
They founded the nonprofit Lansing's Bridge to Recovery, where volunteers and local contractors rebuild these bridges. Many of the residents they've helped are low income and often elderly. A single bridge can cost around $150,000. The maximum FEMA payout covers about a third of that. For every dollar the nonprofit raises, they're able to build $2 worth of infrastructure because of volunteers and donated materials. Like when Emily Davis reached out to her former professor. Civil engineer Shannon Chin started a class at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte to train students to design some of these bridges.
She actually gave us 13 addresses, and we have 13 students, so they each take ownership of one.
Careful, careful.
Yuri Obaka took the class last semester. Now he's marching out into the stream, holding a pole with a transmitter on it to record the water's depth.
Our goal was to build a bridge that's able to hold 20,000 pounds, dedicated for an ambulance. That's the heaviest it could hold.
The road, or in this case, bridge, to recovery has been a long, unexpected one for Leith Davis and his wife. Many weeks, it's like a second job, but he's not mad about it.
At the end of the day, the motivation is exactly what it always has been, and that's we have the ability to leave it better than we found it, and we intend to do that.
Lansing's Bridge to Recovery has already rebuilt over 90 structures, and nearly 150 projects remain in their queue. For NPR News, I'm Zachary Turner in Lansing, North Carolina.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. More states are planning to stop people from using food assistance to buy soda and candy. Yesterday, the Trump administration added Utah, Idaho, and Arkansas to the quickly growing list of states allowed to implement this policy. This on top of the proposed budget cuts to the program, the largest in history. NPR's Katie Riddle talked to one family about how this might affect their lives.
Meet Solomon Church, 10-year-old nutritionist. He's standing in the cereal aisle at the grocery store. He lives in a rural Oregon town called the Dalles. Solomon points to the sugar content on the side of one box.
6 grams and has protein 9.
Protein, he explains, is the most important ingredient, and vitamins.
Because if you get something that doesn't have vitamins, your body doesn't grow.
Solomon is here with his mom, T. Church. The family gets about $450 in benefits a month from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. The administration says this ban on soda and candy will help reduce chronic disease and improve nutrition. T says nutrition is important in their family, but so is being able to give her kids choices and being able to buy some special treats.
And so for some kids, it's like the most meaningful way that they feel love and connection. And so being able to give them something that doesn't like negatively impact our budget is amazing.
She's a single mom to five kids. Her oldest are in high school. T says for them, soda and energy drinks have a special role.
I have social currency for our teenagers.
T's oldest daughter, Olivia Church, wasn't at the store, but on a phone call, she says her mom is right. At her school, some kids arrive in the morning with $7 Starbucks drinks. She can't afford that, but because of SNAP, she can afford Red Bull. She says walking into the first period with one in her hand helps her feel normal.
You know, I would never be able to be a part of that social pyramid if we didn't have the SNAP benefits.
The administration argues taxpayers shouldn't be subsidizing unhealthy food and beverages, but paying for energy drinks is a minor problem compared to another obstacle this family could be facing. As part of the effort to cut the program, the current bill imposes work requirements. T. Church would have to work 20 hours a week to keep her benefits.
As a sole provider, there's no way that if the requirement was 20 hours a week, that would drastically negatively impact our family.
This rule would apply to families with kids over the age of 7. One of her sons needs a lot of special care. It's possible she could qualify for a disability exemption, but that's unclear.
Because even though chronologically he's 11, social emotionally he's more like 6.
T says SNAP benefits are critical to getting through this time in their life.
And it's not that I don't want to work. It's not that I'm unable. We live in such a rural community, and his needs are so significant, and care out here for a child like him is virtually impossible.
There are more than 40 million people on SNAP. Experts say as many as 1 in 4 recipients could be affected. It's possible some states would end the program altogether rather than try to make up for the cuts. T says she thinks efforts to curtail SNAP don't take into account the fundamental purpose for programs such as this one.
It seems like they were created to be able to care for members of our community.
Caring for people, says T. Church, by making sure everyone has enough food. Katie Riddle, NPR News, The Dalles, Oregon.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A prominent whistleblower within the Southern Baptist Convention who brought national attention to sexual abuse in the church has died. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose reports that Jennifer Lyle suffered from a series of strokes and died at just 47 years old.
In 2019, Jennifer Lyle said publicly that she'd been sexually abused and assaulted by a professor while studying at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. At the time of her disclosure, she was a senior executive within the Southern Baptist Publishing Company.
Jennifer Lyle was just a young, bright, shining star in the SBC.
Karen Swallow Pryor is a scholar and writer who worked with Lyle.
I credit Jennifer Lyle with making many of us in the SBC see and face for the first time what had been there in front of us all the time: too much toleration of misogyny and even abuse and cover-up of abuse.
But Lyle's disclosure of the assault led to a strong backlash within the Southern Baptist Convention. She was bullied online and denounced from pulpits. Still, her friend and lawyer Rachel Den Hollander says she loved the church and worked for its success.
It was the place that signified family to her. She had come from a very difficult childhood and background, which her alleged abuser was aware of and manipulated and used when he was abusing her and assaulting her.
For a time, Lyle's coming forward did seem to make a difference. The SBC did an internal investigation and voted to create a database of abusers. However, those reforms have stalled. The denomination cites, among other things, insurance reasons, although those are disputed by lawyers, including Den Hollander and others who helped draft the framework for abuse protections. Despite the lack of progress, Den Hollander doesn't want her friend's legacy to be entirely about sexual assault and misconduct within the church.
She was brilliant, and yet she was also intensely personal, so deeply compassionate, cared so much about the people around her. The person who could do the highest level of math and would sit down in the backyard and color with my 3-year-old with chalk.
A friend, says Den Hollander, who died too young and had so much more to offer the church and the world. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
Donald Trump is the first person to hold both the title of president and of convicted felon. His efforts to erase his criminal conviction, even while in office, continue. A federal appeals court in Manhattan heard arguments today over whether his criminal case should be moved to a federal court. More than a year ago, Trump was found guilty on all 34 counts of charges surrounding hush money payments to adult film star Stormy Daniels ahead of the 2016 election. Trump has been vowing to overturn the conviction ever since. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf was in the courtroom today. She's here now. Hey, Kat.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay, set up what this hearing was about, because this case was over. We already had sentencing. What was today?
Yeah, so like you said, this hearing today was really all about whether or not this case, which has been prosecuted in the New York State Court, can be moved to federal court, even though sentencing has already taken place. This is something that Trump's legal team has been trying to do for a while. A district judge has denied it twice before, and today they took it up with the federal court and brought their argument before a 3-judge panel in a U.S. Court of Appeal.
All right, so take us inside the courtroom. What were the arguments being made?
Yeah, so Trump's lawyers keep citing a specific law that allows federal officials under prosecution to move a state case to federal court if the case involves conduct while in office. That last part is key because the hush money payment at the heart of this case occurred before the 2016 election when Trump was not in office. But today, Trump's lawyer argued that prosecutors during the trial relied on evidence from Trump's first term, like testimony from former Trump officials, you know, Hope Hicks, for example, and that made the case relevant to the president's official duties. The Manhattan DA's office maintains that it still falls under state jurisdiction. And, you know, the judges in the hearing asked a lot of questions, and they were sometimes receptive, sometimes skeptical of both sides. The judges made it clear that this is a highly unusual case, and there's a lot to think through because the U.S. courts have just never been presented with this situation before.
Well, I'm remembering when this was all playing out in the courtroom last year, I think we were all glued to it, or at least many of us was. What was the scene like there today?
I mean, it was definitely more subdued. You know, this is an appeals hearing. The courtroom was totally full, packed with press, but Trump himself was not there. He didn't have to be there for this type of hearing. You know, at his sentencing earlier, though, he appeared by video, and that was earlier this year. And, you know, he maintained his innocence, saying he was treated, quote, very, very unfair in the trial.
And what's the timing here, Kat? Do we know when to expect a ruling?
The judges will have to confer, and they'll issue their ruling at a later date. We don't know when. But legal experts I talked to have said this argument is a long shot. They don't expect the judges to rule in Trump's favor. But they've also pointed out that, you know, if they do, there could be larger implications. Here's Stephen Vladek. He's a professor at Georgetown Law School. He says that if the law expands the ability of federal officials to move out of state courts,
the more you're widening the scope of cases that can be removed from state court to federal court in ways that really are, I think, arguably usurping the role of state courts in our system.
So basically, he says it's a kind of workaround that could take state courts out of the picture.
That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, sports fans, you know the routine. If your team wins while you're sitting in a particular spot on the couch while wearing some old ratty t-shirt, you know you must repeat that act throughout the playoffs, right?
Right, indeed. And sports teams, no different. Take, for example, the Edmonton Oilers. They are fighting right now for the Stanley Cup, and a certain song has taken hold. God, what have you
done? You're a pink pony girl. Oh yeah, you know it, Chapel Roan's Pink Pony Club. She gives shout-outs to places in California and Tennessee, but she says nothing about the Canadian province of Alberta or the city of Edmonton.
And yet, Elsa, since the playoffs, they have been grooving to it in the stadium, also the locker room.
And it seems to have started casually enough back in March when there was a sing-along for fans. How did it grow so much? Well, when the team has been asked directly why this song has been the song they rely on, the players, well, they refuse to answer.
Yeah, the Edmonton Sun reports that goalie Calvin Pickard says, quote, "Well, I know exactly where it started, but I don't know if I want to let that secret out. I know exactly when because I was there," he says, "but I think I'm going to keep it tight to the chest."
Fine, we didn't want to know anyway. Perhaps if they do take the cup, it's a best of seven series, they will reveal the true power of the Pink Pony Club. In the meantime, here's to the magic of that song.
Yes, may it work for you, Edmonton Oilers, just like Baby Shark did for the Washington Nationals in 2019. You will remember.
Oh, yeah.
Eat it. The rest of you who are not Nats fans, they won the World Series clapping their fins.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D.